All right, welcome to Start Writing. As you know, we've made some changes to how we do interviews. We are now trying to keep our interviewees focused on the topic that we're tackling at the moment. We've been covering dialogue, and we want more than just mine and Jay's opinion on the topic. So today, I'm going to be interviewing Sandra Montaneo, who I have been in a live writing group for years. So the novel she's talking about today, I have seen it through multiple drafts and read multiple versions of it, and it's very good. So Sandra, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself a little bit more?
My name is Sandra Montaneo, and I am, I did live in three countries by the time I was eight. And the exciting thing for me was that I grew up in a very multicultural family, multi-ethnic, multilingual, multi-superstitious. And I think my mother was always on the hunt for more superstitions. She thought that was the best way to live life. But I come from a family of storytellers. It's an interesting thing, but as time goes by, we start to lose a lot of the stories as people pass away and the stories pass with them. It occurred to me that even though I came from so much ethnic background, my grandchildren are not. They have names like Baker and Bessex and Heim and Holt and Powell, you know. There's not, none of them end in a vowel. So that's a telltale sign right there. So I just thought, you know what, I'm going to have to tell them what it was like back in the day. And the sad thing I think about all of us is that we do not ask enough questions when the people in our family, matriarchs, patriarchs, are with us. And, you know, we just kind of do our own thing. And then when they're gone, we think, oh my gosh, you know, why didn't I find out this or that or whatever? So I decided to write it all down. And of course, if I'm going to say this or that, the other, if I make it into a story, they're going to want to know what comes next. So I decided to write The Weight of Salt, and it just came out the end of December and on Amazon. And I'm really proud of it because it does tell a story that was very influenced by my grandmother Angelina and her Sicilian father. Well, both her parents were Sicilian, but her father had a very strong opinion of what it was, of what life should be, very drummed into him from Italy, comes to this country. And then my grandmother, who was very kind of free-spirited, very intelligent, and very ready to grab the horns and live her life, found out that she was in an era where women couldn't even vote and had hardly any rights. And the conflict between the two of them became the stuff of family stories. And every time I went to Florida, my cousins would say, oh my gosh, your grandmother and your great grandfather and blah, blah, blah. And so I thought, you know what? This is a really good story. I'm going to have to put this down. And so I, you know, I wrote a few little stories. I won some awards with the League of Utah Writers, and people were running around asking me about my book. Well, I didn't have a book. And so I thought, and they kept right on asking me, well, what about your book? And I thought, wow, well, I guess I darn well better start writing a book. And I thought about it. I've been a realtor for a lot of years. And I thought, well, I'll write about being a realtor. And then I, all of a sudden, the light bulb went off in my head. Oh my gosh, my grandmother and my great grandfather. Okay, there's my story. And I wrote down 18 chapters of what each chapter should be. Anyway, I took a lot of stories from my family, for my extended family, and but everybody's gone. So I had to piece it all together with my imagination. Anyway, I'm very excited about it because it is something that my granddaughter came in here and she said, oh my gosh, you've got something here that my grandchildren, and she's 21, that my grandchildren will be able to read. And I thought, oh yeah, I'm going to be the one relative everybody's going to remember in the next millennium. So anyhow, I'm really happy with it. I'm glad I did it. And I am writing a book two and a book three. And
can you give me just the short little summary, you know, kind of conversation version of your blurb on Amazon?
Yeah, the story starts out in 1906. It is Angelina, which is the protagonist. She's 15 years old. And it starts out with a very dramatic story. As a matter of fact, I was just looking at this some notes I'd written, and I thought, you know, when you write a story, you want to definitely put in things that are identifiable, relatable to other people, right? So I thought, geez, so what is in this story? So I have, you know, I have love and anger and heartbreak and superstition and culture and belief and a stillborn and jealousy. And you know what? That's all in the first chapter. I thought, well, I must have hit somebody's nerve there. Yeah, I think that as long as the story is relatable and people can understand, because these are emotions that all of us have. But, you know, she was in a time when the Black Hand, which was the precursor to the mafia, they came to this country and they, because they didn't speak English, they made life very difficult for Italian immigrants because they're the ones that they got for extortion. And, you know, you'd have to pay them protection. And if you didn't, they destroy your store. They went mostly for the owners of stores. And my grandfather had a little grocery store. So he was up for it. And kind of tells the story of that, how that was maneuvered in his life. But also, you know, it tells the story of the suffragettes, because this is a girl who wanted to go out there and get an education and make a better life. And all of a sudden, I mean, there's not a lot of places, you know, when I looked it up, where she lived and where she could go to college was like something like 2.5 hour drive or something. I mean, there's just wasn't the opportunities. So that was another thing. But her biggest thing was the mindset of her father and hers were not even close. I mean, she was the first American, you know, the first generation American, and he believed in the old. Matter of fact, there's a line in there where she says, you know, Italy has nothing to do with America. And he answers back, it has everything to do with America. It was discovered by one Italian and it was named by another. So anyway, but it's a good story. And it's a story about a time when Ybor City, Florida, which is where they lived, was known as the cigar capital of the world. And it tells about that era. And I think it's a really powerful story.
Tell me what genres you've decided to put it in. I know this was something you really wrestled with.
But, yeah.
So I'm asking this to help the listeners identify if this is a story for them, right? Because we pick stories we want to read based on their genres. That's why marketing companies have them. And so that's why I asked the question.
Well, it has a lot of history in it. And so I always thought of it as historical fiction. But there is a line. This is a 15-year-old girl, and then she's 16, 17, 18. So what happens? You know, at some point, she falls in love. And I think that that's the way it goes, especially since there's so much conflict at home. The main thing is that I was told that it would also qualify for historical romance. And I didn't set out to write a historical romance, but it does get it does fall, I guess, into that genre also. But it also falls into Italian immigrant story. And it also is what they would call a woman's literary fiction.
So if I remember correctly, you rewrote a few scenes to push it more towards romance, right?
Yeah, we did. Well, see, I was a little worried about that because I never wrote it as a romance. And I wasn't sure if the audience would expect it to be, you know, I think romances are very formulaic. And so on page so-and-so, they meet, and on page so-and-so, you know, they fall in love or they hate each other and they're fighting all the way through page so-and-so. And then at the end, they have this wonderful, you know, romantic thing with the fireworks and everything, you know. And because I didn't write it in any special sequence, I wasn't sure if the romance readers were going to come after me, but they keep telling me it is also a romance, but I think it kind of falls in the cracks of the two genres.
Okay. And then if you could compare it to a popular author today, who would you compare it to, or book, a very well-known book? What would your
I haven't read something that I think really compares with it. But, you know, if I went back a ways, I think it compares with, it's kind of a family saga. And it's a kid who is questioning a lot of stuff. So I kind of in a way falls like Angela's Ashes. That my favorite book that have fall that I feel, and it's an old book, but it's by Betty Smith, and it's A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. That one is really one of my all-time favorites. And I think, there's a lot of them that I think it's really the dynamic in the family. Even Norman MacLean's A River Runs Through It. I love his first line, in our family, there's no clear line between religion and fly fishing. You know, I think that's a cool line, you know. In Angela's Ashes, he says, Frank McCourt says, it was, of course, a miserable childhood. A happy childhood is hardly worth your while. Worse than the ordinary miserable childhood is the miserable Irish childhood. And worse yet is the miserable Irish Catholic childhood, you know. And so I think I feel like we fall more into those areas. I was very, very motivated by Isabel Allende's The House of Spirit. And that's also about a family and the dynamic, but it is a bit intense and different, and it gets a lot more dramatic, I think, than my book does. But I do think that it motivated me to really dig deeply. It depends on what kind of a writer you are too, because, you know, a lot of writers are, I think there's really two kinds of writers, in my opinion. One is the one who, you know, who flowers up the descriptions and, and goes into great detail about, you know, the weather or what somebody's wearing and whatever. And we need these guys. I mean, they are so good. And I really, really, I belong to the other group. My group is the ones who go for the dialogue. And I don't describe as much as somebody else would. Matter of fact, I'm not even sure I ever described Angelina other than she was 15. And I think somewhere in the book I said she had brown hair and brown eyes, but it sure wasn't at the beginning. And so the descriptive writers are very, very impressive, very, very necessary. They do a beautiful job. But I am more along the lines of the other bunch, the dialogue-driven writers.
I interviewed a woman before who, when she writes a book, the first draft is just the dialogue, and then she fills in everything else. She's like, this is the part I like and is easy for me. She's like, everything else, just fill in after. It doesn't matter. It's just getting you from dialogue one to dialogue two.
Yeah, well, I'm indebted to my family because they were great with one-liners. I noticed that as I was writing, I just realized this recently, is that I do a lot of stuff with questions. And when I was young, if I did something my mother considered unsafe, she would say, "Are you trying to kill yourself?" You know, that was her question, you know. If I wasn't eating, do you want me to think you don't like my cooking? And I know if somebody in our family wanted to spend a lot of money on something, you know, they would say, "Hey, your name is Montanino. Who told you you were a Rockefeller?" So these are things that I found myself writing a lot of questions as opposed to just explaining things, you know, like, if the world's too complicated, you don't like it here, why don't I stop it, the world, and let you get off? I like these kinds of interactions because they're more lively. But I know that a lot of the descriptive writers would have written something very, very beautiful at that point. Way different than me.
Okay, so let's go into dialogue a little bit deeper. I think you might have a few examples prepared. And then, give us the examples and then talk to us about how they came about and whatnot.
One of the things, because I was talking about asking questions, I found that I could, in a dialogue, I could raise the tension with questions as opposed to answering them. And there is a scene in the book where this man who was in love with Angelina's mother and comes in and grabs her arm, and he's lost his whole business and everything, and he's having kind of a breakdown. And the father comes home and she says, "What happened?" And so the father gets very angry and he leaves to go meet up with this guy. you know, like, why'd you grab my daughter, whatever. And I think the scene got really good. I mean, I really liked the idea that I didn't answer the question. So her father returns and did you talk to Claudio? Everything is fine, right? These are questions. And then he says, Claudio Garcia is dead. So Angelina starts screaming and he says, you know, what is wrong with you? You know, do you hear me? You know, why are you screaming? And she said, how could you kill him? You know? And so these are still questions. Then he said, I had a reason to be angry, not to murder. And then she says, then how did he die? And he doesn't answer. He says, well, calm yourself and I'll tell you. Papa, how did he die? You know, the man lost everything in a fire. Papa, how did Claudio die? Some people can remember what happened. Whatever happens, the sun will rise again tomorrow. What does that mean? So there's 9 questions there, and he doesn't answer it till he gets to the very end. He still hasn't answered it. In the next scene, he does answer it. But I think that kind of dialogue, and maybe it's because I'm used to questions, is I think it does keep, rather than answering it or showing, you know, everybody sitting down and crying or showing emotion, I kind of liked it because it kept the suspense going, and the reader wondering, yeah, how did he die? You know, what happened? You know, kind of same thing. The fire in the factory, when it catches fire, her friend Carmen is very panicked, and Angelina is trying to keep her calm. And so Carmen says, "What if we can't get out before it's too late?" And Angelina answers, "What if the fire's already out?" I mean, so that's the point, you know, it's just kind of, the questions are great. And if you answer a question with a question, it's kind of a little more fun. And then in regular kind of dialogue, she has this back and forth in the confessional, the baby dies and they're going to put the priest is saying the baby's going to limbo. Well, limbo isn't done anymore. But in those days, limbo is kind of this in-between space between heaven and hell. And you don't go either place. You just kind of sit there for all eternity. So the priest says, you know, the baby died during birth with original sin, because if you die with original sin, it stays with you. So he'll go to limbo, but he never sinned. Everyone is born with original sin of Adam and Eve, washed away only by baptism. When an infant comes into the world without a sound, dead, and with a cord around his neck, as Dottore Martino said, the sin remains. Angelina leaned closer to the screen, separating them. Maybe the baby couldn't make a sound because the cord was wrapped around his neck. And maybe he didn't move because he was unconscious and about to die, but not dead. He could have lived long enough to remove original sin. Why not baptize him now as a precaution? What would it hurt? The position of the church is clear. And then he says, no one goes to heaven with original sin. So that's an exchange there that I think explains also, I think it's important to realize that obviously not everybody's going to understand what limbo is and original sin and all that. So I think it's important when you're writing, especially dialogue, find a way to add it into the exchange without sounding, and I forget the term for that. Well, as you know, Bob, I don't know what that term is. You got to be careful so it doesn't sound too planted. Okay, well, there's also an angry scene between Domenico and his sister-in-law. The mother's dead, and so the sister-in-law decides to come and take his children, which happened to be 6. So she says, and she's very wealthy, and the children are entitled to privileges you cannot give them. I can give them a father. Step aside, Domenico. The children need a proper home, not a house with a grocery store stuck to it like a tumor. You cut your throat with your tongue, Violetta. You are nobody, Domenico, and you have nothing. Then you should fear me. A man who has nothing is capable of anything, because he has nothing to lose. So that was that one. I don't know. Want me to keep going?
So I guess the next question I wanted to pose is, what is some of the best advice you've ever gotten about dialogue? Whether it be you read it in a craft book or someone said it to you or anything, and it maybe changed the way you thought about the process. So what is some of the best advice you've gotten on it?
Well, I think, like I said before, I think it has to be realistic, and it has to be relatable, and it has to tie into something that's going to, you know, strike at the reader. And we all have, everybody in life, you know, has good days and bad. They fall in love, their heart is broken, and all that stuff. So you have to tie into something that I've read several fans of books who have thanked writers for saving their lives and giving them hope. And that makes me feel really good. And it also responsible that when you write, you have to be sure that you are doing it in a way that is not going to incite a riot or something. I have a cousin that broke all our hearts, and he committed suicide on the 19th. So his mother called me, and she's very upset because it's coming up now, the 19th of January. And in my book, there is also a suicide. So the question is, what happens to the person when, you know, when they go on to the next life? And I was very, very conscious that I didn't want to say the wrong thing. And I was very carefully wording it. And I felt like I did a pretty good job. And I told my cousin about it. She just bought the book. And so I think she got it today or something. But anyway, I think the responsibility is always going to be that be careful what you say, because you don't know who's reading it. And I think if you can say something that is in a positive vein, it's really good. But I have heard a lot of readers say, if it wasn't for this book, blah, blah, blah. Of course, it wasn't my book. But, you know, I think that that's a huge compliment to the author, that they put something down that it was very relatable and uplifting to the audience. So that's my two cents on that.
So when you are doing your outlining or your editing, is there anything like specifically you think about to improve your dialogue?
I feel like reading other people's books are very important. But I think one of the things that all writers either do or should do is always keep paper and pen with you. I mean, I've had panic moments where I'm writing on the back of receipts and the back of my checks on napkins. But somewhere you go, you will hear a word. And sometimes it's just one single word. And you think, oh, my gosh, that word can really work in my book. So you really do want to have your mind open all the time. And I have actually, this will kill you, I have 28 pages of sentences that I've written that don't have anywhere to go. I just wrote a sentence and I think, wow, I love this sentence, but where do I put it? You know, so I just leave it in there. And anytime I'm writing, I keep a split screen with my sentences and to see if there's anything in there I can use.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so it's a really great thing. I just have, I call it suggestions. And then and there are 28 pages of them. But actually, if I put, you know, for example, I could say Angelina or Domenico or Signora Bertelli or whatever, I can actually go through it and say, oh, Signora Bertelli would say this. And so I put this under her name. And that's how I start organizing it. Mm. And then eventually, as I'm writing, I go in and I said, oh, perfect. This, she would say this at this point. And I switch it over because dialogue is so important. And I don't want to lose something. And very often I hear something that is just, sometimes I'll be watching a movie and I'll hear a line and I'll think, you know, I don't want that line. But that line reminds me of something else I could say. And I actually jump up and run to the computer and stick it in my suggestion overloaded document. Yeah, I do that. And sometimes if I see something in someone else's writing that I think is wonderful, I'll put it in there for inspiration. And I have a section called inspiration. And I think that that is real, real helpful because, you know, I have a little scene here that I could read to you. It's the women. And the reason I thought of it is because I had this in my suggestion blurb thing. And I finally pieced it all together. And it was Angelina's in the factory. The women are discussing men. And so one woman says, and I wrote this line and I loved it, but I had nowhere to put it. It said, she says, to love is to suffer. No one cries louder than cheating husbands. I thought I could make my husband lose his bad habits. Another woman sighed, but all he lost was his hair and some teeth. He left and took my money and my parrot. She paused. I really missed that parrot. The women giggled and the mood lightened. You see that, Angelina? Just because I got married doesn't mean I have a husband. It means he got a wife. The man I married likes to spend our money and gamble and saves his voice for talking to the dog. Ava reached inside the pocket and showed everyone her coins. Before I met him, I was an heiress. Now, this is all I have left. Some men are good. I hit the loteria with mine. That's a lottery. He thinks I'm a princess, came another voice. And this other woman says, your husband is wonderful. Atención, señoras y señoritas and señoras. We have an heiress of Havana among us, a princess, and I'm the Queen of Spain. Pleased to meet you, said Eva. Who wants to tell Cuesta, that's the owner, he has a princess, an heiress, and the Queen of Spain in his factory on the third floor stripping tobacco leaves. So that was something that I kept collecting. And I thought, you know, eventually we'll have a conversation. It's just really important to, I think it's really, really important for a writer to be hyper aware of words. And there is this one, I see if I can figure out where I put it down, but in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, it starts out very unusual. It starts out with the importance of words. This is the very first paragraph of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. This book was written several decades ago. I think I read it when I was 20. Serene was a word. That was the very beginning of the book. Serene was a word you could put to Brooklyn, New York, especially in the summer of 1912. Somber is a word that's even better, but it did not apply to Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Prairie was lovely. Shenandoah had a beautiful sound, but you couldn't fit those words into Brooklyn. Serene was the only word for it. I thought that was really insightful because it meant, it shows the importance of words. And as the story goes on, Francie, who's the protagonist, wants to be a writer. So I think that's a really great way to start. Maybe it doesn't apply to other people, but I liked it.
I do have this question. Do you, in what you've prepared for the interview, do you have anything with Pasquale in it? Because those were always my favorite scenes. Like the stuff that would come out of his mouth was just amazing and crazy at the same time.
Oh, let me see if I have him in here. I don't know if I did. You know, the problem is that I don't know if people realize it because he's got that thick accent, you know? And let me see. I know I had something in here about, you should have reminded me and I would have made sure I put
it
in.
I wanted you to pick the examples that you thought would best present your book. So I tried not to steer it.
Yeah, well,
if she prepared Pasquale, I'll make sure to cover it because I always enjoyed a scene with Pasquale.
There was one about, let me see if I have it in here. Okay, this is one. It is with Pasquale, I think. Yeah, it is with Pasquale, but I let go of the accent. So Pasquale, they're talking about how, you know, Angelina knows that there's a lot of poverty in Italy, you know? And so they're talking about this rich man. Pasquale says, Signore Costa, he has a cow, so he makes butter and he puts it on both sides of the bread. Then he walks around and eats it so we don't forget he's a rich man. He gets fat too. Only the rich get fat. Domenico nodded. I remember that old man. He wore two different shoes so everyone would know he had two pairs. It's true. Only now he stomps his feet so we don't forget to look. Pasquale tells all the fun stories, and I didn't know how long. I mean, some of them are a little long, but yeah, it's he talks about the cat who sneezes, and that's good luck, and he's all excited because they're going to go get a job because Signora Bertelli's cat was sneezing. And then because it didn't sneeze again, he told Angela, well, that's okay. We'll share one good luck between us. Anyway, yeah, Pasquale, I think that that's a good point too, because I think, you know, life is funny and it's heartbreaking and you cry and you laugh and everything. To me, that's what's important in the book, is that you can make your reader laugh and you can make your reader cry and you can make it like real life, because in all everybody's life, there are moments of both. And I think that going back to being relatable, I think that's what makes it relatable. And so because Pasquale came in as a comic relief, and so did Signora Bertelli. You know, the two of them go back and forth. And then Carmen is another one. She's more sarcastic in a friendly way. But I mean, she's got a lot of fancy one-liners. I think that's important because there is a lot of drama. I mean, in this book, there's everything. Like I said, suicide, and there's murder, and there's falling in love, and there's the mafia, and oh my goodness. There's almost everything that could happen happens. And I think that's what keeps people turning pages. I read a book that was really very, very beautifully written, but there was really not a whole lot of happening. Everything was gorgeous descriptions, you know. You know, the sun and the moon and the breeze and the trees and, you know, but I think the whole point of writing a book is to tell a story. So get that out there, you know, don't get bogged down with this, with other things, even though I have great admiration for people who can write beautiful stuff like that. It really is a gift.
Okay. So I do want to talk about your journey to publication. Because it was, you know, winning awards and agents and more agents and movie deals, and just, it was a roller coaster to get here. So tell me that story, because I think a lot of the listeners will be interested in that.
Well, it's really funny. It started out, I think I wrote 24,000 words. The book is 93,000 something, but I wrote 24,000 words, and I was in California, and I was already being approached to make it into a movie. And I thought, that's crazy. I don't even have the story yet. You know, that's not very far into a book. And then I had another guy call me after I turned the first guy down. Another guy, and that guy sent me a contract. And another guy called me, and he said, that he really wanted it. He said, we haven't had a good Italian story since The Godfather, and I'm excited to make your book into a movie. And I said, yeah, but I'm not excited to do that yet. I don't feel like it's ready. So you know what he told me? He says, well, it doesn't matter if it's ready, because get this, we're going to change it anyway. And I thought, oh, no, you're not. I mean, you know, this is an African-American guy, and he was going to change my Italian story to his liking. I thought, this isn't going to work, you know. But anyway, I was real appreciative. And but no, I told him the book has to come first. If it gets changed afterwards, the book at least came first, you know, so we know what the real story was. And then another couple approached me, and they sent me over a contract, and they were really raring to go, and they were getting people to, you know, they were lining up stars. They said they were going to tell me who they were until they had it all into a contract, but they was big stars. I was going to be so impressed. And I don't know what it was, Joseph. I just did not have a good feeling. Something just did not click. And so I pulled out of that. In the meantime, and in between, I went to the Southern California Writers Conference, and I won the Outstanding Fiction Award, which is really exciting. And I got approached by two different agents. One was from Germany, and she was, oh my gosh, she called me, she texted me, she emailed me. I mean, just constant. And the other one was a Sandra Dystrup's literary agent. And because the other one was counting me so much, I said, gee whiz, she really must love this story, and I bet she can do a lot. Well, she got it approved. I'm not sure how you do that. I'm very interested in knowing now. But she got it approved in 11 countries. They all wanted to publish it. And I'm happy to say the very first country was Italy. And she got it done in Germany and Japan and Norway. I have a list of them. But the thing on it had to be that the United States was going to publish it, and it had to be with one of the big publishers. The book really wasn't 100% ready yet, and I knew it. And I did my best, but, you know, it wasn't really ready. And so it didn't get accepted. A lot of lovely, you know, it's a wonderful book, you know, and blah, blah, blah. But it didn't get picked up. So I pulled away from her. And she kept telling me that there is a writer, her name is, I think, Adriana Trigiani, and she wrote Shoemaker's Wife, and I don't know what all she wrote. She's very pretty well known. And she says, well, she's Italian, and she wrote this Italian story. I thought, so what? I mean, how many people have written about World War II? I mean, come on. I mean, just because somebody wrote a book that's got Italians in it doesn't mean that I got to back down, you know? So anyway, that didn't go anywhere. And then I contacted again, Sandra Dystrup's literary agency, and Joe Marr said, oh, yeah, I want the book. And that didn't go anywhere either. But I made a good friend. She's really a nice person. And I also made real good friends with the editor. And he and I still talk all the time. I think in anything that you do, you know, have the dignity to realize your book is ready. It's not ready. It's going somewhere. It's not going somewhere. And I feel, and I wish I would have, I didn't know about beta readers. I never heard of that. And had I known, I think my journey would have been a lot swifter, because I'm really, really happy that I'm self-publishing it. I really am, because I don't feel like I'm under constraints for anybody else, and I'll get more than 12 cents a book or something, you know. But the main thing is that I knew my book could be better. And I think part of my problem was my father. He was a writer, but he wrote magazine articles and things like that. He never wrote a book. And he said to me many, many times, life is too short. Don't waste your time reading good books. Read only great ones. Now, I got raised with that sentence. So when I started working on my book, I thought, oh, it's a good book. It's not great. It's good. Well, it's probably never going to be a great book, but it's a whole lot better than what it was. And I felt like I did the best I could. You know, I mean, other than you could honestly write a book till the end of time. I mean, you could just go back in there all the time and tweak sentences and all that stuff. But at some point you have to say, okay, done. That was a little piece of advice I got from Norman McLean, who wrote River Runs Through It. I remember listening to him talk, and he said, and that book is so tiny. It's only 171 words? No, it can't be words. pages, I think it is. It's a teeny little book, but obviously it was really, really a good book. Yeah, I mean, I'm very inspired by writers, but every now and then, well, I mean, there's books I pick up and I think, holy cow. Did you ever read the beginning of Water for Elephants by Sarah Green?
Doesn't sound familiar. I mean, the title is, but I don't think I ever picked that one up.
Well, I just love the beginning. It says, I am 90 or 93, one or the other. Her first line. You said, when you're 5, you know, you're aged down to the month, you know, and then she goes on. But then in your 30s, something strange starts to happen. It's a mere hiccup at first, an instance of hesitation. How old are you? Oh, you start confidently, and then you stop. You were going to say 35, but you're not. You're 35, and then you're bothered, or 33, because you wonder if this is the beginning of the end. It is, of course, but it's decades to admit it. And then at the very end of that little blurb, she goes back to, I am 90 or 93, one or the other. I love that framing, you know, that's called framing, where you start and you end the same way. And I thought that was spectacular. When I read that little thing, I had to buy the book. I just thought it was wonderful. So anyway, yeah, I have a lot of admiration for a lot of writers. And some of them are interesting because, like, Junot Diaz, he does not use any quotation marks. Oh, and neither did Frank McCourt. There is no quotation marks in those two books. And what is more interesting is I had no trouble reading them. So I don't know, just interesting. I think there's always a cleverer way. I can tell you one time I wrote a paragraph and I went back and I spent, honest to goodness, about an hour and 40 minutes rewriting one paragraph because it didn't have what I felt like I needed some kind of springboard in it. I have one more here I could read you if you want.
All right.
It says, this is Signora Bertelli explaining falling in love to Angelina. Now she's 15. My parents had a good marriage too, said Angelina. Two is right. Two turtle doves, two peas in a pod, two lovebirds in a tree. Signora Bertelli lifted her chin. If only Adam and Eve had been that happy or smart. I mean, who ever heard of a talking snake? One day it will be your turn to fall in love, Angelina. I have no doubt you'll have the most romantic experience. Love makes life magical, she sighed. It will happen all at once and you won't be able to get him out of your head. You'll get butterflies in your stomach and you won't be able to eat or sleep. Your heart will beat so fast when you see him, it's like having a heart attack. Nothing will make sense and your brain won't work anymore. Signora Bertelli looked starry-eyed and released another sigh. It's wonderful. Angelina saw nothing wonderful about it. Falling in love sounds unhealthy, painful, and dangerous. So, that's the kind of dialogue I like. Snippy. Do you have another question for me?
That is it. Yeah, I think we've covered everything I had. Okay. So why don't you tell people where they can find you and your book?
Well, I have a website, just sandramontanino.com. It's S-A-N-D-R-A and then M-O-N-T-A-N-I-N-O. And I am on Amazon. The book is called The Weight of Salt. It's got a lot of good stuff in it, The Weight of Salt. And it's by me, Sandra Montanino.
So, all right.
I hope somebody likes it. Oh, and please leave a review if you get it. Please leave a review. An honest review. You can hate it. I'm okay with that.
As long as the review is good.
Yeah. No. Just give me a review. I don't care.